things which tell us that we need to believe in this ziyara, because of the fact that many great Shia scholars, they have quoted this ziyara in their books of supplications and prayers and ziyarat. And second of all, this ziyara contains some high and great content which cannot be issued by any person other than an infallible imam. And of course, let me also share this point, okay, that the content of this ziyara is in line with many other ziyara texts. This, yes, is another qarina, another indication.
That's right.
So it doesn't contain something which is against the other ziyara texts that, yes, we have for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam. So, okay, it seems that at least according to the majority of the Shia scholars, Ziyara Nahya Muqaddasa, yes, is an authentic, yes, ziyara text for Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam.
In this ziyara text we read, peace be upon the parched lips, peace be upon the plucked souls, peace be upon the snatched spirits, peace be upon the stripped corpses, peace be upon the pallid bodies, and peace be upon the gushing blood. These are referring to Imam al-Husayn alayhi salam on the tragedy of Karbala 61 AH. Thank you much, dear listeners. Till another episode, God bless you all. Assalamu alaikum, Ya Abu Abdullah al-Husayn.
Inna fil jannati nahran min laban. إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن لعلي وحسين وحسن لعلي وحسين وحسن كل من كان محبا لهم كل من كان محبا لهم يدخل الجنة من غير حزن يدخل الجنة من غير حزن إن في الجنة نهرا من لبن إن في لعلي وحسين وحسن
Internet Trolls Part 1 The Internet. What began as an exclusive tool to connect militaries, governments, and then universities has now, more than 60 years later, transformed everything about how modern societies operate and communicate. Today, no one can escape the grasp of social media or evade the mind-boggling connectivity that nearly all humans worldwide now have access to. But few have been prepared for what has also emerged with all this human connectedness. A new and ominous strain of human behavior has been unleashed. Increasingly, people are hiding behind a cloak of anonymity, waiting to provoke, harass, and even threaten anyone they choose. They are called Internet Trolls.
A troll is someone devoting large parts of their life to attacking other people on the internet, basically trying to make that other person's life miserable in some way.
They send things to my home. It terrifies me to think what they could do if they wanted to, knowing exactly where I live, knowing where my children go to school.
Trolls can be a minor annoyance or a life-crippling terror. But what happens if society tries to silence them? Who loses then?
Trolling is a free speech issue, and if you aren't free to hate someone, then you're not free.
I've been associated with all kinds of organized trolling groups. We're stretching the bounds of free speech. You either use it or you lose it. Feelings will be hurt.
Politicians and the courts are now grappling with who really is a dangerous troll.
I've been called troll by very powerful people that should know better. Homophobe, misogynist, racist, all this stuff is just lazy people not wanting to interact.
Artist Gregory Allen Elliott is at the center of a landmark trolling case that might land him behind bars and forever change what any of us anywhere can or cannot say online.
If Mr. Elliott is convicted of a criminal offense, watch out. Nobody will be safe. You better shut up, because if you don't, he could be going to jail.
My name is Gina Crosley Corcoran. I write a blog called The Feminist Breeder, and I deal with a really steady onslaught of very vicious and dedicated trolls. Trolls can be really, really sneaky. When you think about patterns of stalking, stalkers don't just do it really quietly. They leave their victim clues that they're being stalked in order to scare them. So today I got a Working Person's Store magazine addressed to the Feminist Breeder with my home address. My trolls sent me this, probably to imply that I'm too lazy to find a real job besides blogging.
Gina's blog earns her family a decent income. She writes about being a stay-at-home mom, but from a pro-choice, modern feminist perspective. And a large, active community of like-minded women has grown around her blog.
I like to see that recognition response when someone else goes, oh, me too. And that's so validating. That's why I do it.
Feminists are frequently targeted by trolls. Gina knew to expect attacks, but she's been overwhelmed by the volume of abuse and stunned to discover who her trolls are.
The trolls and the really dangerous people that I attract are themselves mothers and have small children at home. They get something out of taking out their frustrations on someone like me. They see me as a figurehead, and they're really angry about the attention I'm getting from people, and they want to discredit me in any way they possibly can. These people spend all day taking screenshots of every word I type on the internet. They all pick it apart. They talk about my children. They talk about my clothes. They spend an incredible amount of energy focusing exclusively on something that they claim to completely hate. And to me, that's the difference between someone who just disagrees with you or someone who's really stalking every move you make. And those are the trolls.
Gina sees little difference between her trolls and a stalker. They want to see her react, and they know how to push her buttons.
A stalker wants to upset that person. They want to make them afraid. And that's what these trolls do. They leave comments in such a way that makes you feel afraid of what they're going to do and say. They'll leave comments about my address or my kids, and they do it because they want to get a reaction out of me. They want to see me lash out, and it all feeds into this sick and twisted entertainment value to them.
So what is it that motivates trolls? In London, England, psychologist Raj Prasad believes the internet has spawned an entirely new, yet unexplored, set of human behaviors.
Psychologists and psychiatrists have been somewhat taken back by the huge amount of negativity there appears to be on the internet. And it may be that the internet has unleashed a kind of dark demon within millions of people out there in the general public. We think that one of the things that's problematic about the internet is it normalizes extreme behavior. So because you see a lot of people on the internet behaving in an extreme fashion, you think it's more normal than it might actually be. And the other thing is it seems to encourage a herd-like piece of behavior. If one person starts being negative and a group of people pile in behind them, There's a kind of cascade effect, which you don't see in ordinary life outside of the internet.
Psychologists further believe that one thing has compounded the effects and numbers of trolls.
Anonymity seems to be a very important factor on the internet in that it seems to make people less inhibited about doing nasty things. It means that people feel free to get away with bad behavior because they think they're not going to get called to account. No one's going to point the finger at them. So the anonymity effect seems very important and may explain why so much dark and negative and extreme behavior occurs on the internet but doesn't seem to occur in real life, in face-to-face interaction.
But what inspires a troll? What do they get out of it? Operating out of an undisclosed location in North America, one hardcore and self-professed troll agreed to tell us, provided we maintained his anonymity.
I'm Wild Goose, and I'm a member of the Bill Wagoner crew. And I've done a podcast for the past several years documenting internet troll activity, hacker activity, Gamergate, Anonymous, Occupy, you name it. I've been a part of it. There's a serious darkness in not only us, but I think in everybody online. I think a lot of people just don't tap into the power of anonymity and what it can do for them. When you're anonymous, you're free to do and say a lot of things that you otherwise wouldn't do in real life. You would be powerless to do in real life.
Goose joined forces with like-minded trolls he met online, and they work as a team to offend and infuriate as many people as they can.
If you were to Google Bill Wagoner crew, chances are you'd come across a term called rip trolling. When somebody dies and their family puts up a memorial up in their honor, we might set up a separate page, or we might just go on that page and create a ruckus. But the idea is to get as many followers as possible on that page and make it seem as legit as possible so that we can offend as many people as possible when we start posting gore and other kinds of shocking material.
Hounding people when they are most vulnerable, like at the time of a loved one's funeral, is a surefire hit for the troll.
That's the easiest way for us to create a mass effect. It's really effective when you have all these people who are already emotional. You drop this bomb on them, you know, with the gore photos, maybe some kind of sexually explicit photos. It sends their emotions into overdrive.
But what do the trolls get out of seeing these distraught reactions? Lulz. L-U-L-Z. That's the currency of the troll, and it's what they're after. Lulls are laughs, fun and amusement at the expense of others. The Wagoner crew will prod people online for reactions. The bigger their response, the more popular the target becomes.
Someone who gets really animated and waves their arms around on camera, preferably, or they'll scream into a microphone on a podcast. They might start crying. They become a lulz cow. They're like an ongoing target. We love that kind of reaction. We want to make them cry. We love to make them cry.
The open internet is a playground for goose and trolls like him. And the stark contrast to what they can get away with in normal society is not lost on them.
I really can't. I mean, the real world's so boring and it's lacking in lulls. It really is. I don't think we'd be able to find this in real life. The internet presented something that was never available to us before.
Today, if you go on the internet, you're entering the domain of the troll. But where did internet trolling all start? This unassuming computer science professor may hold the answer and may himself be one of the very first trolls on the internet.
I'm Dr. Adam Steele. I am an associate professor of computer science at DePaul University in Chicago. I think I'm the first recorded troll on the internet. Certainly not the first troll, but the first one that was actually written up. This is a piece that is here because my wife hates it, called The Alchemist. I hadn't really noticed, but it sure does look like a troll, and I guess he's stirring the pot.
Adam would first access the internet while attending university in the province of Quebec, Canada. And it wouldn't be long until he was stirring the pot with his wry sense of humor.
I was a grad student in 1993 at Concordia University in Montreal. Essentially, at that time, the internet was still very nascent, and at that point was just a relatively small number of universities that were connected together. And there was this kind of quasi-bulletin board system called the News Network. You had, for example, a group like Rec.Humor, and people would trade jokes, and I guess what happened at some point was that there were people on Rec.Humor who had a certain penchant for tasteless jokes that was not appreciated by the rest of the community. And so the tasteless denizens were kind of hived off and started their own group, and Alt.Tasteless was born.
As the chat group Alt.Tasteless got going, the jokes started to get more and more extreme. But soon, the jokes just couldn't get the rise they wanted.
I think it was a long, hot summer, and everybody was kind of getting a little bored. And there was this idea that the people of Alt.Tasteless should invade a news group, and somebody suggested Rec.Pets.Cats.
Yes, cat lovers would be the next target, and Adam would be the lead.
Like any community, they wanted to discuss problems that their cats had. So I guess my contribution was that we should actually engage them by writing a story that would appear to be from somebody who was genuinely concerned, get them to respond, a stealth attack. So I created a fictitious identity, and it was posted anonymously to Rec.Pets.Cats.
And what happened next would be recognized by Wired magazine as something that had never happened on the internet before.
I have two cats, Sootikin, 2-year-old female, and Chode. Chode's problem is that he has really stinky shits, paint peelers.
Adam's post was vulgar and over the top, but he took care to keep it believable.
Sooty goes into heat something fierce, yowling and presenting all the time. While dinner was cooking, I tried to stimulate her with a Q-tip because I had heard that one can induce ovulation that way. My date came into the bathroom while I was doing this, and needless to say, I don't think she bought my explanation.
The cat lovers, however, bought Adam's story, hook, line, and sinker.
And the initial responses to the post were very helpful and essentially suggested that Sooty should get spayed. Then slowly, other suggestions started popping up.
As the off-color suggestions became grosser and more extreme, the cat lovers were outraged, and the Alt.Tasteless gang had a blast.
So what we did was we essentially trolled, you know, where you throw a lure out behind a boat and motor slowly over the fish until somebody bites.
Adam and the Alt.Tasteless crew had become the internet's first gang of trolls. Back then, Adam was one of about 14 million internet users worldwide. 25 years later, there are 3 billion people online, and the nature of trolling has evolved.
What's happened now is that trolling has taken on a meaning different from the sort of phishing metaphor and more towards that of the troll under the bridge, where someone will post something and the responses will be very destructive, basically laying waste to whatever's been said.
In the early 1990s, Adam and his friends were trolling for fun. But now, negativity is everywhere on the internet. Back in London, Dr. Raj Persaud suspects that we all have a potential troll lurking in our psyches.
The answer to the question of whether we're all potential trolls is delivered by a simple question. Have you ever gossiped negatively about someone else? Because if you have, there's a sense in which you are doing a kind of micro-trolling behavior.
It's not pretty, but science has now proven that putting someone else down can make us feel better about ourselves. And there's a specific name for the feeling that results.
Psychologists are taking increasing interest in what's called the Schadenfreude effect. And Schadenfreude is a word from German, which is about feeling pleasure at someone else's downfall. There are a lot of people on the planet feeling low self-esteem, feeling beaten up by life. Maybe watching other people do badly, watching other people suffer, seems to correct your low self-esteem.
Deriving pleasure from the pain of others is a characteristic we all seem to have to a degree. But psychologists are now finding that hardcore trolls are likely to express four dark personality traits. In Winnipeg, Canada, a landmark study of internet trolls has now shown that one of those dark traits stands above the rest. Sadism.
Sadists do it because they like it. Some people get their jollies by being rude and obnoxious and causing harm to other people, sometimes serious harm to other people, and it gives them pleasure.
Dr. Paul Trapnell and his colleagues have confirmed that the internet, with millions of potential victims and anonymity to hide behind, is a playground for people with sadistic tendencies.
It's a venue where a person can go on and ruffle somebody's feathers or embarrass or humiliate them or make them feel anguish, and there's no consequence to that, and it's easy to do. So that might attract people that take pleasure in harming people, and that seems to be what we found.
Trapnell and his team began their studies by focusing on people who frequently leave comments on message boards. A significant number of them unabashedly rated trolling as their favorite commenting activity.
Then we asked them to also fill out a number of personality questionnaires, and those questionnaires included some measures of well-known, widely studied forms of nasty tendencies. We found, as expected, that the trollers were higher on all of the malevolent traits. It's not a stretch, but nobody had investigated that with data. And so we did so, and sure enough, that's true. Let me illustrate what I mean by these four dark tendencies that have specially toxic social consequences. Psychopathy, we can be callously indifferent by our reckless pursuit of things that we want. In narcissism, we are callously indifferent to others by our pursuit of grandiosity and wanting to hog the limelight, wanting to think that we are superior to other people. Machiavellianism, the pursuit of strategic harm in order to benefit ourselves. Sadism is a particularly malevolent way that we can do harm to others, and that is by seeking to harm people purposely because it's pleasurable to us. So all of us have the potential to be dark in these four different ways. And indeed, some people combine these tendencies in ways that make them especially dark, malevolent individuals. And that is a very, very malevolent person. This is not somebody that you want to have anything to do with at all. Definitely not.
Nasty individuals have had free rein on the internet, and trolling is on the rise. But more and more people are starting to fight back. This accused troll has been forced off the internet for 3 years by a Toronto court. And today, his artwork has been forced off these cafe walls by angry protests. Gregory Allen Elliott is in limbo, awaiting verdict in a landmark Twitter harassment trial.
When I used Twitter, I used it as pure form. As an artist, I just went, this is a brush, this is some paint, this is a canvas. I used it to comment on politics. I used it to help people. And I just used it every way possible. One day, I responded to every tweet that came across my tweet stream. And then someone said, you don't have to respond to everything. And I said, I know, right? But today, that's what I'm doing as an artist and an experimenter.
At one point, Gregory was sending 300 tweets per day. He was acerbic, sometimes crude, and very opinionated. Inevitably, he made some enemies who wanted to shut him up.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
According to the search warrant executed by FBI agents at the former U.S. President Donald Trump's home on Monday, 8th of August, he's under criminal investigation for potential violations of the Espionage Act and additional statutes relating to obstruction of justice and destroying federal government records. We now present you an article written by Julian Borger. The piece is titled, Nuclear or Not? Classified or not, Mar-a-Lago files spell out jeopardy for Trump. Over the course of Friday, 12th of August, the circumstances of recent FBI search of Donald Trump's home at Mar-a-Lago in Florida have come into much sharper focus, which makes them look much worse for the former U.S. president. The unsealed search and seizure warrant shows that it was carried out, in part, under the Espionage Act, a set of statutes dating to 1917 that have been used aggressively to go after leakers, whistleblowers, and the WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange. The code quoted in the warrant carries a maximum penalty of 10 years imprisonment. The inventory of material taken out of Mar-a-Lago leaves in no doubt the importance of the documents discovered there. They included top-secret and sensitive compartmented information, meaning there were restrictions on its circulation over and above its top-secret status. It should normally only be in a special facility, a SCIF, a Sensitive Compartmented Information Facility, or SCIF, was established at Mar-a-Lago, but it operated as a secure facility only during the Trump presidency. Altogether, there are five sets of top-secret documents listed, three sets of secret, and three sets of confidential documents, as well as binders of photographs and, intriguingly, information about the French President Emmanuel Macron. It was the warrant that was unsealed by court order on Friday, 12th of August, not the supporting affidavit from law enforcement, which would have provided a lot more detail. So there is no confirmation one way or another on the Washington Post report that there were nuclear weapons documents among the trove. Nuclear or not, that is an awful lot of classified stuff, especially in view of the fact that 15 boxes of documents had already been removed in January after discussions between the National Archives and Donald Trump's representatives, and then again in June under a grand jury subpoena. Papers removed on Monday, 8th of August, were held back even after that subpoena, and their continuing presence at Mar-a-Lago was confirmed to the FBI by an informant. In the wake of all that focus on the documents, the possibility that they were retained by accident is extremely small. It also looks significant that, in seeking a court warrant, the FBI did not invoke Code 1924, which is normally used in the case of government employees who hang on to documents they should not have. Instead, the Justice Department used Code 2071 relating to the concealment, removal or mutilation of documentation, and Code 1519 concerning the destruction alteration or falsification of records in federal investigations. Stephen Vladek, a law professor at the University of Texas, said, "That suggests that the government has reason to believe that President Trump has done more than just hold on to these documents." The Trump defense strategy appears to be twofold. One part is the catch-all claim that anything bad must have been planted by the FBI. That is an extraordinary scorched earth path to take in the absence of any evidence, particularly considering that there has already been an attempt by a Trump supporter on an FBI field office, leading to the attacker being killed by police. It may also be legally untenable, as there appears to have been video footage of the search that was available to Trump's representatives to closed circuit television at the time. The Trump camp may not care about that, of course, as long as it muddies the waters. The second strand of the Trump defense, quite contradictory to the first, is that while he was still in the White House, Donald Trump declassified all the material in question by presidential fiat. That would be unusual to say the least, and would not be how declassification is supposed to work. Asher Rangappa, a former FBI agent, special agent, said on Twitter, "Whatever the president's powers might be to declassify documents, there are good policy and practical reasons for them to follow a process, and for that process to be documented and reflected on the document markings themselves." The Trump Defense Counsel could argue that that is not how Donald Trump rolled. His style was to do things informally. But to a great extent, it is a moot point anyway. The Espionage Act predates the system of classification introduced by executive order after the Second World War, so it makes no reference to it. It talks about national defense information. It does not distinguish between classified and declassified materials, unauthorized retention of any document relevant to the statute remains a crime. However, it is a leap from Donald Trump having a poor legal defense to the prospect of his arrest or criminal charges, steps that would have dramatic political consequences, to say the very least. Although it is called the Espionage Act, it does not necessarily mean that Donald Trump took the documents with the intention of passing them on to a foreign power. The statute also covers more minor offenses. For example, someone who is lawfully in possession of documents, photographs, and so on, and passes them to anyone not entitled to receive it, or fails to hand it over to officials who ought to have it. It can also apply to someone who, through gross negligence, permits the same to be removed from its proper place or custody and fails to report it. Fines can be imposed, and the U.S. Justice Department may be satisfied with getting the second documents back under lock and key. Stephen Vladek said, "I still think an arrest and a prosecution are low probability. From the government's perspective, it seems like at least part of this exercise was about just removing things from President Trump's possession, and that's been accomplished, whereas arresting him and prosecuting him raise a whole different slew of political complications." One of three statutes cited in the search warrant, Code 2071, contains a clause stating that anyone who willfully and unlawfully conceals, removes, mutilates, obliterates, falsifies or destroys government documents shall be disqualified from holding any office under the United States law. Here again, Stephen Vladeck is skeptical over whether this can be enforced for this kind of offence. Vladeck said, "There are questions about whether Congress can disqualify someone from the presidency through such a statute." He added, "I think there would be a serious constitutional challenge to Congress's power to disqualify the statute unrelated to the 14th Amendment, unrelated to the insurrection." According to the search warrant executed by FBI agents at Donald Trump's home on Monday, 8th of August, he's under a criminal investigation for potential violations of the Espionage Act and additional statutes relating to obstruction of justice and destroying federal government records. The search warrant, that the contents of which were confirmed by The Guardian, shows the FBI was seeking evidence about whether the mishandling of classified documents by Donald Trump, including some marked top secret, amounted to a violation of three criminal statutes. Most probably, the search warrant authorized FBI agents to seize materials from Donald Trump's residence to investigate crimes in connection with the Espionage Act, which outlines the unauthorized retention of national security information that could harm the United States or aid an adversary. The other statutes listed on the search warrant include the federal law that makes it a crime to destroy or conceal a document in order to obstruct a government investigation, and a federal law that prohibits the unlawful removal of government documents more generally. The inclusion of the obstruction statute could be an indication that the Justice Department is investigating Donald Trump not just over the potentially unlawful retention of records, but also whether he attempted to impede the separate or wider criminal inquiry. The disclosures, which came in an attachment to the search warrant, mark a dramatic escalation in the U.S. Justice Department's criminal inquiries into Donald Trump. They represent perhaps one of the most treacherous legal and political moments faced to date by the former president. A conviction for violating any of the detailed laws would be severe. The Espionage Act has a maximum penalty of 10 years in federal prison, and the statute for obstruction has a maximum penalty of 20 years in prison, while the statute for destruction of records can also bar anyone convicted from holding future office.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to the program Islamic Upbringing. This is a program wherein we provide you with necessary information to be able to provide necessary grounds for your children to flourish and to attain perfection, which is the ultimate goal of Islam. Will be providing us answers on the basis of Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. Friends can help you celebrate good times and sometimes provide support during bad times, and at the same time, they could take you to a direction which you, after some time in your life, really regret. To know more on that, we have Brother Miqdad in our studio. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome, brother.
Thank you very much, and to all the listeners out there as well.
Well, we have been talking about the role of friends in the teenager's life. You discussed so many beautiful verses, so many beautiful narrations in the previous episodes, and we talked a lot. What do we have more to talk about the role of friends in the teenager's life?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So we talked about how great of an influence is friends in our lives.
Yes.
And so the first aspect, or the first dimension that we talked about, is the influence of friends in our actions. And we saw how when we're together with friends, especially in that moment where we're together, and as I say, you're chilling with your friends and we're doing things together, we're very much influenced by how the group is thinking and what the group is doing.
Mm-hmm.
And this group action or peer pressure is very strong and very difficult to go against.
Yeah.
Very important thing to mention over here as well is also the lack of action is also valid as well in the same reason. So there's a lot of things that we want to do because we're good friends. So as a simple example, when the Adhan time comes, for example, and you're with a group of friends that don't pray,
yes,
it's very difficult to say, hold on a second, I want to pray, because nobody else is praying.
Okay.
So the lack of actions is also something that will lead me to not perform something.
Okay.
And so if I'm any youth, if they're youth that pray, they will say in their minds, I'll pray later. Right now, it's very difficult to go against the group and say, oh, you guys wait for me, I'm going to pray. And so peer pressure at this level is very strong.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to realize this. But it doesn't end over here. Friends also influence our thoughts and the conclusions that we make in our lives and the attitude that we have, the worldview that we have, how we define success, how do we define our relationship with Allah, how do we define respect of others, how do we
look at life
in general, the purpose of life. You find that this is very much influenced by our friends. Again, so many stories you can share about youth that you know that when you speak to them, I remember this, you want to tell them, like, this is not you speaking, this is your friend speaking.
Okay.
And then they'll swear to you, no, this is what I believe in. They'll be like, no, I know where this is coming from. This is not from you.
Where this is coming from, yeah.
So you realize that the attitude that people have in relation to their lives, in relation to success, in relation, these things are very much influenced by the people they hang around with. And so our friends have an impact not just on our actions, but also on the kind of conclusions that we have about life, about general ethics and ethos and principles and values and identity. These are very important. So you'll find that youth that get together and they are from a particular background will value certain things that others will not. And if you want your child to, or if you, your child or your teenager ends up with a particular group, his way of thinking will be based on that group. And this is, again, something that you'll find very much researched upon.
I will be talking more on that with you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
Hey, stop! I got a better game!
IRIB English Radio presents a priceless gift to parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIV English Radio. This is Islamic upbringing. Brother, I was recently talking to a mom who was really, really concerned about her teenage daughter, who she said that her life is changing tremendously, dramatically. She used to be even when it was not wajib, obligatory on her to pray or to fast, she would do all those things. But as she got mature, as she entered the teenage, and as she gets, you know, elder day by day, and now she's influenced by the company she keeps because of the friends she's hanging around with are not offering prayers, and this has affected my daughter. How can I help this?
One of the things that we can do is to increase the interaction that we have with different types of people.
Okay.
So very often teenagers build, as you mentioned in this concerned parents question, is that they have a pocket of friend and they stick to that pocket of friend basically. Why? Is because their level of interaction with different type of people is very weak.
Okay.
And this often happens because we've got a very routine life and we stuck with one particular place and we stuck with our own habits and we're not exploring enough to go out and meet new people. And that's why, for example, very importantly in teenagers' life is to travel.
Traveling,
I would recommend parents a lot to help their children to travel.
Okay.
The more people you meet, the less you're attached to a particular group
particular
of people.
Particular person. Yeah.
Exactly. So one thing that you could do is the level of interaction that you have with different types of people is very important. So if you're going to a mosque, for example, every week, then maybe once a month, for example, go to a new mosque.
All right.
Right? A new Islamic center. Even if it's further away, for example, if it's an hour's drive, for example, it's worth the drive to go and see a new center, to go and meet new people. If you're going
come out of that daily routine, repeated life.
Exactly. So from a young age, children are interacting with different types of people. Mm-hmm. And this will open up their eyes, their experience, their ideas, their thoughts. So this is one. Secondly, encourage your child and your teenager to have more than one friend, to increase their numbers of friends and their circle of friends. Ideally, you want them. One of the other advice I give, but I guess it's one of those advice that you would really hope people would pay attention to, is to have more than one child. A lot of these issues come with children that are single child families. Remember, the best friends that you're going to have is your brother and your sister.
Siblings.
So siblings, as much as you can have. I would say four is less, right? I know parents that have four that they say four is less. You want your child and your teenagers to always have a sibling as their best friend.
Yes.
Because that's a person you can trust, right?
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that's really important to work on, I guess this is before they hit the teenagers, is to be so family-oriented that you don't necessarily have to rely so much on friends.
Okay.
One of the things that happens, I guess this is for another discussion some other day, but just to allude to it over here, one of the things that happens is that people, as teenagers, become friends. I don't use the terminology for it. You could say an exaggerated interaction with friends, that they're so close to one another that you can't see one without the other.
Okay.
I'm sure you've seen this, right? When there's two girls
obviously,
or two boys, they're so close to one another that if you see one,
actually obsessed with each other.
Exactly. They dress the same, they talk the same, they do everything together. They can't do something without the other.
Yes.
This obsessiveness is very dangerous. And we need to,
how
as parents, be careful.
How is that dangerous?
That.
I'll ask you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIP English Radio.
Ya Muqiy al-Khayrat, Ya Muqiy al-Khayrat.
The Prophet sallallahu alayhi wa alayhi wa sallam said, raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. We're talking about the role of friends in the teenager's life. Brother, you said there's a nature, obsessed nature, like when they are teenagers, especially girls, because I remember a friend of mine who used to buy a fairness cream for herself and she would buy the same for me. And I was like sometimes upset with or like amazed on her, you know, whatever she would do. But yes, this is there because I have personally experienced that.
So in many cases, this actually, in extreme cases, you actually go to a psychologist because it's a mental health issue as well.
Mm-hmm.
The obsessiveness very often stems from a lack of self-esteem, from a very weak personality, an inability to do things on their own, to believe in the greatness of their own soul, to always be dependent on somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
So in itself, it's very detrimental. We have to be careful of this. We should never allow it to happen to this extent. So for example, and this is why, for example, we often say your levels of interaction with other people should increase. As parents, we should monitor how much time they spend together, etc. It shouldn't go into exaggerated levels, basically.
Try to travel as much as we can.
Exactly.
Looking at our budgets as well.
And teaching your child to be independent, teach your teenager to be independent of people, not to rely on people. This is very important. And we have this in our advice from the Ahlul Bayt as well, that as a true believer doesn't rely on people.
Yes.
And that doesn't mean that he does everything. Obviously, it's impossible for us to live in this life.
Because we are social beings at the end of the
day. But within us, the Ahlul Bayt have taught us that within us, you should be in such a state that you don't rely on a particular person. Your attachment to a person and your feeling of dependency on a person should never be there. Right?
Okay.
This is very important. This brings about true strength. Such that if a person ever goes in the wrong, for example, your best friend, for example, makes a big mistake in their life, or for example, even God forbid, goes astray, for example, you would not be affected, right? You would be so strong that your life carries on.
Yes.
And you still remain with the truth. And so your attachment to the truth, your attachment to Allah is not influenced by what happens in people in their lives.
Okay.
This is very fundamental. And this is something we need to teach our youth and our teenagers from a very young age. And this requires us to give them the strength in their personality and their self-esteem.
True. Well, that was really an important discussion. And you discussed very important points that how parents could help their young ones to deal with all that. And the most important thing that you mentioned was that we have to make our children so strong. Well, that was all for today. Thank you so much, brother, for joining us. Thank you so much to our listeners for being with us. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. In case you have any questions for us or any suggestions, comments for a program, please feel free to contact us on englishradio@irib.ir. You can also search us on our social media platforms by just searching Call of Islam Radio. In case you want to listen to our programs again, you can go back to our official website. That's www.parstoday.com. Until another session, fi amanillah, God bless you all. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space, returned upon rest.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.